Hello and welcome. My name is Alex MacPhail and this is High Performance Teams. I'm a former aerobatics display pilot from the South African Air Force and I love talking about high performance teams, what makes them work and what we can all learn from them. In the show, we talk to race pilots, professional sportsmen and women, entrepreneurs, comedians, performing artists and more. Please enjoy and remember to subscribe.
Good afternoon to you. Welcome. Today I'm very privileged to be joined by Ben Murphy. Ben has a distinguished aviation career, having been a Harrier pilot in the RAF, number two in the Red Arrows, the leader of the Red Arrows, and now a Red Bull Air Race pilot. And he's also led the Blades aerobatic team. Excuse me. I'm looking forward to this conversation. It's going to be all things high performance teams, lots of energy, lots of excitement. Please stay with me. My name is Alex MacPhail, and this is High Performance Teams. Ben, how are you doing today?
I'm very good. Thank you, Alex. A pleasure to be here. Hello, everyone. I'm looking forward to our chat. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm freezing here in Pretoria. It's particularly cold and I have no sun on me. So I'm wrapped up in a blanket here. But thank you so much for your time today. I know you're a very busy guy and I really appreciate it. You are one of the people I've been wanting to talk to for a long, long time. We met up in Italy in 2010 the first time and I've been following you from a distance. So I'm looking forward to this. Just tell me about how much fun you're having. Well, not right now in COVID, but in this phase of your life before we peel back the years a bit.
Yeah, I was going to say right here, right now, I'm looking at that video going, oh, here we are in lockdown. If only we could get back to that. No, having a lot of fun. Thanks, Alex. It's one of those weird things. And in fact, I have a running joke with my wife about, we always sort of think, right, what are we going to be doing in 3 or 4 years' time? Because I guarantee it won't be anything we've thought of yet. And so this latest adventure, the air race bit, has been something I didn't think I would get involved in. But was lucky enough to do so, and we're thoroughly enjoying it. But as soon as this coronavirus goes away, hopefully we can get back to it.
Now, that'll be fun. Yeah, I'm sure we're all looking forward to just getting out there. No flying at all? Is everything grounded for your side?
Yeah, we're over here in the UK. I mean, as I'm sure it is in everywhere around the world, it's slowly sort of opening up. We're flying the airplanes, but literally just to tick the engines over and keep the oils going. But fingers crossed, we can be back to some proper decent flying again in a month or two's time. But at the moment, as I'm sure most businesses in the world are trying to do, we're just trying to keep the cost to an absolute minimum and make sure we pop out the other end in a healthy state.
Sure. And in the meantime, everyone is getting very good with Zoom meetings, Skype meetings, Teams meetings, and they're being online.
Yeah, it's the new norm, isn't it? And it's, I'm discovering parts of my house which I knew never existed a few weeks ago. But it's an interesting time. And I think certainly for us on the Blades, it's forcing us to look at a load of different options and different ways of doing stuff. So I'm a big believer in when there's chaos, there's opportunity. So there's plenty of chaos at the moment. We're just trying to find that opportunity. But that should be a good rest of year, I think.
Yeah, okay, great. Well, let's peel back a little bit now and dig in. So you join the RAF and you do pilot training and you're selected for the fighter line. So, but before that, what was the sort of inspiration? I know your both grandfathers were Air Force pilots too. What was the sort of formative years like for you thinking about flying? Did you do any flying as a teenager?
Yeah, absolutely. And do you know what? I can't actually remember a time or an age where I didn't want to fly or didn't want to be a pilot. And you're right. Both my grandparents were Air Force pilots during the Second World War. So I guess it must have been, fireside, sitting on the floor, listening in awe at these wartime stories from where it probably started. But yeah, all the way through school, much to my parents' dismay, it was pretty much the only thing I talked about and wanted to do. It's what drove me down the academic route to want to be a pilot. And yeah, I guess you're the same, Alex. When you have that sort of passion, it's the only thing you want to do. And I guess I'm kind of lucky in that way because nothing else really appealed to me, and I was just lucky enough to get there in the end. But yeah, it wasn't without its challenges on the way. And you're right, I joined the Air Force in 1997, but it took me 4 goes to get in, and even on the third go, they said pretty much, don't darken our doors again. We don't think you're going to make a pilot. We don't think you're going to make an officer. So please don't bother again. And I always remember that moment because, you know, fast forward a few years to leading the Red Arrows as the commanding officer, I said, well, I think I've pretty much achieved that on both fronts. So, I learned a lot through that, those formative years. And, you know, when you have that burning passion to want to do something, certainly for me, nobody was going to tell me that I couldn't do it. Well, they told me enough times I couldn't do it. That doesn't stop you from, sure, from keeping going and getting there. So.
Okay, well, that's a good story, and that's one of the things I like to highlight on this show is that, you know, people look at the career and people maybe pick up a magazine and see your face and your article in it, and they say, wow, he's done so well. I mean, you look quite young, etc. It must be easy for him. But it's great that you bring it up. And we had some friends as well in the Air Force who, a good friend of mine, he'd applied 6 times, and on the 6th attempt he got in. And I think there's something in that perseverance that builds your character that gets you to get through the next hardship. You know, if you need to upskill yourself just to get through the door, you've learned a new skill of getting through tough times. Were there any more tough times along the way? So we're going to flash up a picture then of when you were in the Flying Harriers, etc. So maybe let's fast forward then to your time. You went to 2 tours in the Middle East there. So talk us about any tough times or just your experiences flying Harriers in war zone.
Yeah, I mean, flying a Harrier in itself was a pretty amazing experience. And certainly, you know, the pinnacle of my Air Force sort of fast jet operational time, certainly. That photo was taken in 2003 as part of the second Gulf War when we're out in Kuwait. And yeah, if you'd asked me a year before that picture was taken whether we would be there doing that, I would have said almost certainly not. So I think that's one of the challenges you face certainly when you join the military is, but it's also one that people don't necessarily expect to happen. You could have a whole career in the Air Force, you know, 20, 25 years and never go to war. So when it does actually come, it's a sort of validation for all of that training. It was difficult times, but we had a job to do, and you don't really think about it, I guess, too much at the time. You just go ahead and do it. But it was a great airplane to fly that one. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
And did you fly it off ships as well?
Yeah, flew off the carrier a number of times, which is again an experience. But sure. I guess that's the beauty of that airplane is, you know, you could be tanking along at 450 knots with a full bomb load, drop your weapons and then come back and, you know, literally decelerate down to nothing and stick it on a very accurate spot on the deck. It's, you know, no other airplane can do that, and it's, you know, it was a massive privilege to fly that, and I do miss those Harrier days, definitely.
Well, it looks like a fun airplane. It is certainly one of those airplanes that also capture your imagination as a youth as well. For me as a child, Harrier jump jet was something that was spoken about a lot too. And obviously, best of British there as well. We could actually spend an hour talking about the Harrier, but I do want to move forward a little bit here. So let's fast forward a bit and tell me about your selection, your application, or getting into the Red Arrows. You started number 2, is that right?
Yeah, so I was selected and joined the team in 2006 for then the 2007-8-9 seasons. And again, it goes back to not knowing where you're going to be in a few years' time. I think if you'd asked me a year before I joined the Reds whether that's where I saw myself going or indeed wanted to go, I'm pretty certain I would have said no. I was a qualified weapons instructor on the Harrier. We were in Afghanistan on operations, and to me that was the complete focus as an operational Air Force pilot. But I think most people in their careers, you know, it doesn't really matter what discipline it is, whether it's flying or a sport or anything like that. I think once you've done everything that you set out to achieve in that area, your mind then starts sort of looking elsewhere. You broaden your horizons, and that was certainly the case for me with the Harrier. I got pretty much most of the ticks that I could get. And then, you know, a few friends had joined the Reds and said you should give it a look. And of course, I was there going, why would I want to fly a red jet? I'm here in my Harrier, I'm completely happy. But then it's just that unknown, it's the challenge. I mean, the flying, clearly, you just have to look at the flying that's involved to know that is exceptionally highly skilled and highly challenging. And that sort of sowed the seed. And so I went for the selection, was lucky enough to be selected and started, as you said, as number 2, which is the right-hand wingman to the leader. I did a season as number 2, thoroughly enjoyed it, and was then selected to be the synchro pair, which is the two jets who do the the low-level high-speed crossing maneuvers, absolutely awesome fun. You will not find a better job. Well, as you know from your time in the Air Force, it's just an amazing job. Thoroughly love that.
And again, there's a sense of sort of I like what you talked about a moment ago, where you said you're in this position, you're learning and growing, and you get to a point where you know tick all the boxes in that sphere. And now there's a new sense of growth, and you obviously firstly you get into the team, that's great, and you're experimenting and you're getting in, you're getting better in the show. Number two, now there's a chance to grow again and become the sort of synchro lead or in the synchro pair, and that's another build up. At what point are you looking around thinking, hey, this could be a long career, or thinking about leading? Was Jazz Hawker your leader at the time?
Yeah, and you would have all met actually in Rivolta, as you said, back in
2010,
back
I think
in 2010. Jazz was leading at the time, and he proposed something that was slightly out of the norm, actually. The normal route to become the leader in the Red Arrows is you do your 3 years as a team pilot. You then return back to your previous aircraft, whatever it is, or a staff posting or whatever it is, spend 2 or 3 years away from the team and then get invited or selected back as the leader. For me, it was different. I was still on the team completing my third year when he proposed that actually I stay and become the leader after he left, which is exactly what happened. So I ended up doing 5 years back to back, pretty much 3 years as a team pilot and then stayed on to be the leader for 2 years. Which is not the normal way of doing it, and certainly not without its challenges. And certainly from it was an interesting sort of switch from team member dynamic to team leader dynamic. Not an easy one to do when you're within that same group, same peer group. But as a next challenge, like you said, it certainly wasn't on my radar even at that time. And to have the opportunity to lead the team that is already. Yeah, it's already up here in terms of your list of achievements. It was pretty fantastic.
So was that one of the considerations why the member would then go away and come back? Is that you're not part of that same group? It was almost a separation from the team just to create a bit of separation and maybe some new blood, as it were.
Yeah, and that's how most of the certainly Air Force postings into those sort of positions work. I think there's a lot to be said for that. But it is, I found it really hard because you've got a bunch of friends, teammates on the one hand, you would literally walk out the office on a Friday afternoon with them being as teammates and buddies, and then you're walking into the office on a Monday as the new leader, and you do have to change your approach. Now that you're responsible for that whole team and the way that you manage that. So I was extremely lucky. I think the group that I had around me were very adaptable to that. So it was actually a lot easier than perhaps I feared. But of course, I knew everybody very intimately as well in terms of their personalities and their skill sets and their strengths and their weaknesses. So at least you don't have to go through that part as a new leader in terms of understanding what your team dynamic is.
Yeah, well, that's a nice point. It's always that bit of the unknown. What is there? How are they gonna respect me? And obviously, there's that sense of if someone's choosing you to be the leader of one of the most. I mean, this is one of the most prestigious flying jobs you could get anywhere in the world, is to lead the Red Arrows. There's not many other jobs out there where it's sort of that's the choice grade. If you're being earmarked and you've been selected, then there's going to come with it that sense of support. But there is that fear because you just don't know. You are mates today and Monday you're the boss. We'll come back to the flying stuff in a minute. But just want to talk me through, Ben, the sort of the ground support, because there's a prestigious role there too. They've got their blue uniform. You guys got the red uniform. It's not just your everyday guys. These are a select bunch of people too that are looking after the aircraft, looking after logistics, etc. And they're also part of the team. So tell me a little bit about your ground crew and your support staff at the Reds.
Yeah, well, I think when most people think of the Red Arrows or any display team like that, it's the nine red jets and the nine pilots in the red jets that comes to everybody's mind. But that is only just the start of it. And certainly without those guys in the background, like you said, the support staff, the engineers, the logisticians, the admins, everything like that, the team just doesn't function. It's that old iceberg analogy, isn't it? You're seeing the tip of it, but without that wide base of support, the whole thing would topple over and there'd be nothing. We had a team of about 100, 110 strong personnel on the Red Arrows. All of them played an absolutely vital part. And you know, the even the guys in the blue suits that you saw in that video were a select part of that team. They're the circus engineers who would fly around in the back seat of the jets with the pilots. But so they would support, you know, at each airfield that we went to on the road. But even behind them, there would be an even bigger support network, you know, getting fuel, smoke, oil, supplies, spare parts to all the various different venues. So, yeah, it was, as with most organizations where you just see a snapshot or the bit that you're being presented with, it's rarely the whole story. The real effort, the real work, the real support goes on behind the scenes, and it is absolutely invaluable. Can't do it without it.
And one of the parts of that video clip, Perti and the new leader of the team, Martin Pert, they brought out a promotional video after their nice North America tour last year, and also a great video. They talk specifically about that time where the engineers are head up against the tank, and they're actually just waiting for that manual click over to know that the smoke tank is now full. And I just love the detail. You know, you've got this fancy aerobatic display team with jets and a big outfit, 100-plus people, but they're doing the basic things, the little things, just to make sure that the job's done properly, actually listening for the mechanical click.
Yeah.
Some fun times.
That team as well, the guys looking after the smoke, you see them in the summer, and the suits they have to wear, the big, thick, plastic, protective suits, so hot, so uncomfortable. And yet for those guys, yeah, they're not the ones being photographed in front of the jets. They're not signing autographs. They're in the back, but they're dedication to making sure that everything is absolutely perfect is, you know, to me, it's more impressive than the guy flying a loop at the front of the team, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a great support. Let's do a bit of the air stuff now. I'm going to put up the video, the second half of that video now, where we can see some nice flying action. Watching that video, how do you feel? How are you thinking back to those times leading the Reds?
Yeah, well, that was 10 years ago. So, yeah, it feels like a long time ago. But equally, it feels like yesterday. I always challenge myself. I said, I wonder if I could jump back into a walk, start it up, and then do that. But like you said, maybe I ought to ask Perti, see if I can still do it.
Yeah, that's great. Also, watching that video, it makes me think, you know, seeing the Rolling Apache, I was the member of the team that also did I don't know if you called it that, but rolling around the smoke anyway. And so comparing your time number two and then the synchro and now lead, what was the kind of enjoyment factor? You know, I say that very carefully, the word enjoyment. You know, there's got to be some sense of sort of pride and enjoyment, knowing you've done it well, etc. But what was the change from being a wingman and nailing it, being the synchro pair and just, you know, doing it well, and now the leader? What was the sort of the change in your approach to it, to at the end of that show, that was good?
Very different criteria, I think, and it's a really interesting question. It's an interesting one, Alex. I think probably as number two in your first year on the team, your measure of success is not screwing it up, getting smokes wrong, getting the colours wrong, staying in pretty much the right place, and just being a stable platform for everybody else to not cause them issues formating around you. When you move to that synchro bit, obviously it's a lot more dynamic. There's a lot more timing that comes into play. Obviously, with the extra dynamism of the manoeuvres, there's a lot more safety considerations to have to stay on top of as well. But when you get the pattern right, so when you're synchro leader and you can put that cross right slap bang in the middle of the crowd on datum, you know, with a howling crosswind or you know, trying to blow you off track. That's probably your measure of success in that regard. And then, like you said, when you make that step to the leader, weirdly, the flying, you know, clearly the flying itself, yeah, you're now at the front, you're the stable platform that everybody else is formating on. The dynamic manoeuvres, they're all gone. You're literally flying a loop by just easing the stick back, and then you're just locking your arm and holding it. So so pure flying wise, it's less of a an excitement than perhaps being leader of the synchro pair. But the rewards you get from, you know, putting on a perfect show, keeping the whole formation centered, like I said, on datum, dealing with the weather, dealing with the airspace, making sure everything is on time to the second, that has a massive amount of pride, because it's, you know, it's only you that can do that. And of course, the other issue you have as the leader is that if you realize that you're slightly on track, off track, and you need to be over there, you can't just return your jet and move yourself there. You've got eight other guys formating off you. So, you know, and certainly for some of the high profile flypasts, you know, down the Mall, for example, to Buckingham Palace, you know, if you're not lined up from, you know, 3 or 4 miles away, then, you know, tough luck. You just have to ride it out, because any slight turn is going to throw the whole formation into chaos. So, yeah, but to be able to do that, fly over the Queen, nail it to the second, that's, as the leader, is that's a good measure of a job well done.
Yeah, and that is, and also you just have that sense. So tell me about the feeling that you would get, besides obviously looking at the stopwatch for the Queen, the flypast, but like in an air show environment, you're giving a vertical display. What are you feeling as the leader when you know this is going on? You know those days where you're just in sync and you can just feel that this is it, I'm in the zone. What are the feelings that you're getting, knowing that you're getting it right each time? What's going through you?
Yeah, well, we're a pretty self-deprecating bunch, and I think all Red Arrows pilots will agree that there is no such thing as the perfect show, where everything absolutely goes on rails. We always feel that there is something else to learn and something to improve on. But you're right, you can get pretty damn close sometimes, and some days it just seems to happen for you. Weirdly for me, the times that used to happen was generally when there was a lot going on. So when there's a lot of, weather decisions to make or timing issues, or, you know, when the pressure is higher, that seemed to me to be the time where you're just operating at this elevated level. And, everything's happening very quickly, but in your head, people refer it to that scene in The Matrix, don't they, where everything just seems to be happening in slow motion. And, that is definitely something that I felt in the racing as well, is that when you have a good race and a good run, it just seems to be, everything seems to be in slow motion. I don't know what that is. I'm sure a psychologist would love to explain it, but that is the sensation I had, certainly.
I think I must get a sports psychologist up on the program as well. Yeah. Before we get to the racing, I want to just ask you a couple more questions on the Reds as well. As you describe it there, certainly the days where there's a bit of bumping, you are somehow flying a better show. When is that crystal clear, smooth, calm air? You know, if you're just a bit out of position, that was all you. It was you that caused you. Yeah. Whereas when you're fighting the bumps, you can kind of ride it a bit and feel a bit more comfortable about it. But in terms of the Reds now, what was the sort of preparation and the execution with precision and review? Those are kind of the three things about incremental gains, high-performance teams. The Reds is quite unique, or certainly one of the few unique teams, in that you've got your three different levels of shows. I remember chatting with you years ago that you got the high show, the medium show, and the low show, but you're also able to dynamically adjust it as you go. So how would you brief your team, knowing that going into this show, it could be a dynamic? We could start off a high and end off a low, or go down to a low and end in the medium or the high again. How do you brief for that?
To be honest, it starts way, way before the briefing, and the key, it's exactly like you said, is every step to getting to that stage where you can execute that is an incremental step. And for us on the Reds, that whole process starts with the leader designing the show. And I always used to like to design a show that it didn't matter which part of the show you were in. So it didn't matter if you were halfway through and you were flying the low show, you know, if the clouds suddenly opened, then you could switch quite quickly to the high show or the rolling show, the sort of the middle show. Some shows were designed not like that. So if you got stuck in the low show, you were kind of stuck in it to the end, if you like. And of course, the other way around is even worse. So if you started in the high show, but then you couldn't stop and go to a low show, then you were really in trouble if the weather closed in. So it starts at that show design. The next bit is the months and months of training that go behind not just all the maneuvers and flying them correctly, but the flow of the show as well. There might be some maneuvers or shapes that are in the high show and they're not in the low show, and vice versa. So making sure those are practiced. Like you said, just making sure that everybody's, it's so ingrained in everybody, all those three different shows, that even if you were to say in the air, regardless of whether it was briefed or not, we're switching to the high show or the low show, or we're going forward, we're going flat in our terminology, then the guys just knew instantly what to do. And I think that's a real key point to bring out, because I would say for most of the pilots, when they're actually flying the show, probably 5 or 10% of their concentration is actually on the show at the time. The rest of it, the 90%, is thinking about all the contingencies. So exactly that, you know, if the show changes now and we go full, what's the next mover going to be? Okay, it's going to move back to this shape, so it's going to be me putting that smoke. Or it could be, if number four has a bird strike right now and has to pull out of the formation, what's the missing man slot for that? So instead of going to that side, I'm going to go to this side, I'm going to put blue smoke instead. So it's thinking through all of those contingencies, all of those potential emergencies, so that if they happened, you know, God forbid, in a public show in front of the crowd, it would be seamless. Everybody would know exactly what they're doing. They know what the loser plan is. They know if, and you know, that's times nine. So there's sure. different variations for each jet that's not there. Different smokes, different colors, different shapes. So just being on top of all of that, that goes back through months and months of training. And you're right, when we're briefing it, we don't cover every single scenario, but I will pick, you know, we'll give them a scenario completely randomly picked, or I'll get the executive officer or one of the pilots just to pick an emergency, pick a scenario, and they'll just make it up. And right, number five, you're in this shape and your engine fails. What's going to happen? Right, he pings up, and then the rest of the team in the briefing room has to be able to pick up the show right there, right then, with all the new changes and variations. And it's that level of preparation. It will probably never happen. Hardly ever did,
sure.
But if it did, then they would be ready. And that's the key defining difference between just going, well, probably won't happen, so let's not follow, let's just hope for the best, and then covering all the contingencies.
Oh, wow. It sounds incredible. It sounds like the amount of preparation that had to go into that in order that you can execute well. I mean, did you film the briefings as well to just have to see the interplay? I mean, I obviously looked at the video footage of the show itself, but in terms of the preparation, what other areas would you have filmed and had a look at just to see, you know, where everyone is in this team? Are they on the same page, etc.?
Well, I guess as the leader, I mean, you don't need to film the brief to be able to pick up on, you know, on the dynamic in front of you. And but I mean, you're right. It's a key part of that briefing process. I mean, some briefs just run on rails and everybody knows what they're doing, but it could be the fourth trip of a long weekend and people are a bit tired and or you know, something's happened which has sort of upset the flow of the day, or you know, with time pressure or whatever. So you do, and I did used to adapt the, yeah, well, instead of doing this amazing spaghetti break at the end of it, let's just come in and land, let's keep it simple. So yeah, you do adapt to that. The debrief, as you mentioned, that is easily the most important bit of the trip, more so than the perceived presentation of the flying to the public. It's how we critique that is going to be where you pull it apart and learn all the lessons and take it forward. So on the red arrows, we never used to fly a display until we debriefed the previous one, and that was just an unwritten rule. The only show you didn't debrief was the very last one of the season, when you were changing teams and going into the next year. So that whole preparation, brief, execute, debrief, learn from it, brief those lessons learned in the next one is a cycle that we used to follow religiously, and I think it's the only way that you can get better in anything.
Sure, no, I love it. And, you know, Ben, we could go on 2 more hours on the red arrows. I want to also just come into the air races. So obviously with a heavy heart, you know, 5 years on the team, you must a difficult decision. Obviously you think of all the good, but there were some tough times too in the reds. I know, you know, making that decision to say it's time for me to move on, you do move on and you actually get out of flying for a short time. But if we can just fast forward a little bit to get to the exciting again, how do you get involved at or get the trials or the thumbs up to go ahead to fly Red Bull Air Races? Tell me about that experience of saying, Ben, you're now in the team, the race for this year.
Yeah, well, I think that started with, you know, same process really as the rest of my flying career is you fulfill everything you want to achieve in that sphere, and then, you know, then you start broadening your eyes and looking out, you know, looking out at what else could be done. I'd flown the Harrier, I'd flown the Red Arrows, I'd led the Red Arrows. I'm now looking for, you know, what else is exciting, different, a challenge out there. And I've been following the Red Bull Air Race pretty much since it started. And we actually had Paul Bonham come to one of our Red Arrows dinners in 2009, the year he won his first world championship. And we had a great evening sort of chatting about the air race and everything that's involved. And then probably, you know, so fast forward to, what are we talking about? Probably 5 or 6 years later, I think, I called him up and said, I'm really interested. Yeah, how do I get into this air race scene? And he listed off the list of prerequisites. You need to be in the top 50 of the world championship aerobatic rankings. And, you know, I'd never flown a piston engine aerobatic airplane in my life. But I just started flying with the blades at that point. And so that was definitely a case of, well, I'm going to come nowhere near to this. You know, it takes decades to get that level of experience in that field. Mm. And then he kind of finished the conversation and said, well, if you can navigate 9 red jets around in the crappy UK weather, you must be open. So he gave me some pointers. I contacted Red Bull Air Race and said, yeah, this is me. I don't fit your normal progression into the Red Bull Air Race in terms of the aerobatic background, but, you know, I am now flying a piston aerobatic aeroplane. I don't have that many hours on it, but what do you think? And I think, as far as from the air racer's perspective, don't forget, it's not just your handling skills in the aeroplane. Sure. There is a lot more to it than that. And what they're looking for is, I mean, you could be the best pilot in the world in terms of your flying hands and your ability to control the aeroplane, but if your mindset is, I'm just going to win at any cost, if you're at a complete disregard from the crowds, the safety lines, you know, the safety aspects of it, if you're going to fly yourself into the ground doing it just to win, then you're not the right fit for the air race. So there's, you know, it's how do you deal with the pressure of the crowds, the TV, the media, whilst you're trying to perform. All of that comes into play along with being able to fly the aeroplane well. So it's very much a rounded package sort of deal. So, yeah, I guess in that regard, my time with the Reds definitely helped, and I could prove to them that, you know, I'm completely comfortable flying under those pressures. And then I just had to go and prove them that I could fly this thing around the track, which I guess I must have done all right.
And so tell me about that feeling, being accepted. Was it a similar feeling to you've been selected now number 2 in the Red Arrows? Is it a similar thing? You're now in, you're through the gate. You're in this select group of people in the Red Bull Air Race.
Yeah. And it was a fantastic feeling. Probably the proudest I've been in terms of my flying career, actually, because everything else for me had a fairly set path. And I knew what the next stages were going to be. This was a fairly or very different and new avenue for me to follow. So hugely rewarding to get that nod to say, yes, you've made it, you're in. And then a huge challenge because there is a lot to learn very, very quickly. And to do well in that sport, it's down to the finest margins against the finest pilots in the world, no doubt. So, yeah, it was a bit daunting, I would say that. You know, even at sort of the stage of my career that I was at, it was definitely it's a great opportunity, but I need to respect it for what it is as well and make sure I really do it justice in terms of the preparation needed to do well at it. But I mean, if you've ever seen a race, you'll see how much fun it is to fly. And I'd say it's definitely the pinnacle of my career so far is being in the air race.
Oh, it just looks like an amazing time. You know, a combination with Formula One and flying. You know, it's almost the best two pinnacles of motorsport, as it were. It looks wonderful. So I want to just ask a few specific questions about the Red Bull Air Race now, or air racing in general. Red Bull Air Race is no longer. But now, in the same process, so you were interviewed a while ago where you've led a team of 100-odd people. So for you, being involved in a team like this now, it's not quite 100 people, but it's a similar thing. I mean, you've taken 9-plus jets across to the Far East and back and everywhere in between, you know, shows out, shows away. This is a similar kind of thing from the logistics and the planning side of things. So in some respects, you've got a big advantage on other people, and now you can sort of focus all the mental energy on the race itself. Tell me about your sort of preparation, execution with precision, and review in Red Bull Air Racing. What does your routine look like on sort of warm-up days or show days? Or you can pick anything, then we can just talk through what a day in the life of Ben would have been.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's there are a lot of similarities in that regard, but there's one interesting dynamic which I will highlight, because it's it certainly struck me when I joined the Rebel Air Race is, like I said, most of the other pilots come from a competition aerobatics background where, yeah, it's literally just you. It's you, the plane. You go out, you do your stuff, you land, and you're pretty self-sufficient. Exactly as you said, I came from a team where you're 110 strong, and you're used to that big support network. Now, when you join the air race, you join what's called the Challenger Series, which is a feeder series to the Masterclass, which is the top level of the sport. And when I joined as a Challenger pilot, of course, it literally was just me. And for the first time in my career, that was I didn't have a team around me. Even a really small team to which to rely on for that support, or it was just a different dynamic. When I then moved up into the Masterclass and I was able to put my team together around me, that suddenly felt way more comfortable. It was a familiar way of operating. So I think most people find it the opposite. They find it more daunting going from the Challengers to the Masterclass, because it's you have to run a team. Mm. For me, that was just business as usual, but a day in the life of an air race pilot. So yeah, I think in exactly the same way, not just as a Red Arrows pilot, but also as a Harrier pilot, and you'll remember this from your military time, and also as an airline pilot, it's having a sort of routine and a schedule, or even if it's in the form of a checklist to follow, it's a process which, if you can replicate that time after time and again, it becomes a flow that almost just happens in itself. So yeah, we have on our team in exactly the same way that we did in the military, your zero time, whether that's your time in the track, you work back a transit time, you work back a takeoff time, you work back a taxi time, an engine start time, a push out time, a prep time. So everything is just a series of timings, and we know that if we hit those times, then everything is going to flow nicely. I used to build in, before we pushed the airplane out of the hangar to go and fly a race, there would be half an hour of what I call bubble time. And it's a term we use quite a lot on the in the flying world, in the military, where, for that 30 minutes of bubble time, I am in my bubble. So, no distractions. Nobody comes up with a telephone call or an interview request, or, even anything trivia like to ruin your concentration. Mm. I'm in my bubble, you don't burst my bubble. And that was sacrosanct. So for me, that was the time where you've gone through all the preparation bit, the analysis of the previous flights, everything's rushing around, and that was your just 30 minutes of, right, I'm just going to follow my process of getting my kit on, warming up physically, mentally, going through your stretches, getting your heart rate to the place where you want it, and also just visualizing. That was the key bit for and I think any air race pilot will say it, visualizing how you're going to go out and execute what it is you need to go and do, because that mental reinforcement, the picture that you want to see, if you go over that and visualize that as many times as you possibly can, you've got a much higher chance of replicating that than if you just jumped in the airplane and tried to go out and fly it. So yeah, that 30 minutes beforehand, the bubble time was hugely important. But even before that began, like I said, we've got all the other various members of my team, Neil, the tactician and analyst, Andy, the engineer, you've got your team coordinator, all inputting various bits to make sure that flight is going to go well, and it all comes to that point, to that culmination point where, when you get in that aeroplane and put your straps on, there is nothing has been left to chance. When nothing's been left to chance, you're not nervous. You've got no stresses in that area. You can literally just focus about going and executing, and that's really, if you've got it right, that's the best way to run into that track. And like I said a few minutes before, when that happens and you're in that track and it's all working, you're just in this almost dreamlike state where it's just, everything is working around you. But that's not by chance. That's through design hard work, operation.
Now, we're just looking at obviously a media shot there for your posters and things, but I imagine there's that bubble time. Does it happen in a quiet room somewhere, or are you around your aeroplane? Are you kind of almost trying to get it one with machine, or where does bubble time happen?
For us at a race, it happens in the back of the race hangar. We've got a sort of partitioned area at the back. And it's, in fairness, it's where the tactician and various others sit, but they know when I'm in that bubble time that, you know, just it's that's,
leave me
that's
alone.
The time. And if they're looking, yeah, you know, I often put a set of headphones on, you know, just listen to whatever music you want to listen to, you know, to get your mind in that correct space. You're visualizing flying the track, which generally means I'm walking around with my eyes shut, just, you know, picturing whichever gates I'm going through and picturing the turns. So, they just leave me to it. They know that's all part of the process. And when that 30 minutes is up, they can talk to me again.
I'm going to give you a bit of a loaded question here as well. So a few weeks back, I chatted with Dario Costa, and he'd created himself his own sort of exercise routine, a wobble board with ropes and a whole thing, just to try and give him the edge to be ready that in the cockpit, he's not worrying about G-fitness, he's just concentrating. Do you have any sort of sports routine? And then the double barrel part is, how do you compare flying these plus 10, 12 G aeroplanes versus Hawk, etc., or Harrier, you know, those kind of, what was the difference in feeling and your sort of physical fitness, the sort of comparison? So just really about your physical routine prep for the races.
Yeah, well, there's a number of elements to that. There's probably the most pertinent one in the eyes of my technician is, you've got to keep your levels of fitness to a certain point, because, you know, every extra kilo of weight that you take into that airplane is an extra kilo of weight that makes you slower. And I remember a fairly hilarious conversation in my first year running the team where, you know, we're talking about all these new modifications that you could put in the airplane, and we could have this. And my engineer, Andy's just scratching his head going, right, you can have all that, but you need to lose 7 kilos of weight to make it all happen. And I was like, okay. And I said to him, if that's the challenge, I will go and do that. And I went and lost 7 kilos of weight. And I guess that's just because I'm a bit pig-headed like that. But you're right. The distinguishing factor about air race is, yes, you're pulling 10, 11 G on these big vertical turns and trying to very accurately fly the aeroplane exactly where you want it. And yeah, there is no doubt that is physically demanding. The other thing is that, of course, a race day on a Sunday is pretty much the end of your week of preparation to get there. So you could have been flying since Tuesday or Wednesday, practicing doing all this stuff. So if you're not completely on top of your physical game, you get to Sunday and you're knackered. Yeah, you know, it's the most important day of the whole race. Yeah, it's the race day. And if you're knackered by that point, because you're not physically fit enough to deal with it, then clearly you're not in a great place. Now, I was pretty fit when I came to the air race anyway, but I made it definitely one of my priorities that I was going to have no physical excuse to not be absolutely on top of my game on a race day. And, you know, I've done a lot of work in the last year or so with my personal trainer, John, and is, you know, very specifically looking at, air race, movements that we have to make and training those, but also just, you know, basic cardio fitness. Building up enough fitness so that your G tolerance is absolutely on its peak. So no, I treat it really importantly. And to be honest, under these lockdown conditions, I'm running loads at the moment. I'm loving it. It's, that side of it never stops. But when you say compare it to a Hawk or a, weirdly, I find pulling 12 G in my race plane strangely easier than pulling 6 or 7 G in a Hawk.
Oh, wow.
I don't know why. It's hard. And if it's in the military jet, because you've got a lot more actual, you know, kit on, you know, G-suits, you know, life preservers, helmets and everything. But probably because it's, you know, in a race plane, you're pulling it. It's a lot much higher G, but it's not sustained. It's, you know, it's probably 2 or 3 seconds worth, if that, of actual high G. You know, whereas you'll remember in Air Force days, you know, you can be sustained 6 or 7 is fly that for 30, 45 seconds. That, you know, that's starting to get pretty tiring after that point. So, I don't know why it feels different. It's the lack of juice or something. I don't know.
I've got a theory. You know, those times when you get into the zone, like you just know, you talked about being hot to the ground crew. I can remember getting hot on the flight line waiting to start, you know, as an instructor, students take long and you can get really, really hot on those summer days. And also, you know, go to an air show environment where it's really hot. It's just part of the job. When you strap into this job, you're going to get hot for a certain amount of time. It'll cool down. You won't be hot tonight, but you're going to be hot now and just suck it up. And I think as well, you get into your race plan. It's like a you know, a snug fitting leather jacket or an old glove. It just, you get into that zone and you feel it. So do you think there's any element of that where I'm expecting to pull X in this plane? So X in this plane is normal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing, I mean, this aeroplane is so capable. I mean, it'll do 0 to 10 G in literally 0.2, 0.3 of a second. It's instant. So, it literally is just an extension of a couple of inches of movement of your right arm, and then you're pulling 10 or 12 G. You definitely get an affinity to how the aeroplane flies, and you prepare your body for that feeling so that you're able to cope with it. I don't think that means that you ever get complacent with it. Definitely sure. Not. And you know, many guys who are not with us at the moment are not, because they got complacent with pulling a lot of G like that. So yeah, I definitely respect it, but you're right. You can get into that zone where it just feels natural.
Oh, there's a picture I've put up there now. A nice shot of your aeroplane. I'm not sure what's going on around you there. You know, this makes me think of those times in the military where you did certain types of operations. But this idea was drummed into your head that you just don't fly under power lines and under bridges. So, you know, when you look at the air race, I know it's a race series that happens very low down to the ground, normally over water. But any trepidation with flying under bridges?
Only if you allow it to be. I mean, if you think about it, actually all you're doing is flying probably, you know, 15 feet off the ground, and anybody could go and fly 15 feet off the ground, as long as you forget about that lot of many tons of cast iron above you. But no, you're absolutely right. I love doing this race. This is the chain bridge at Budapest, and because you're right, if I tried to do that in my day job in the UK, you'd get arrested, you'd be in jail, and here you are being told this is how you fly into the track, and it's all legal. And what you don't see after that photo is the aeroplane actually just easing up to get to the right height to go into the track. So, but yeah, I mean, even in that scenario, that I think that year I was the only pilot, masterclass pilot, who hadn't flown under a bridge in previous races. So they put together a little training package, and we had two normal inflatable pylons with a ribbon strung across the top, and you practiced and you went through it time and time again until you got used to. Yeah, what the ground rush felt like, what your sort of height above the ground, what that picture looked like. So, as with all these things, yeah, what you see is a snapshot. There's generally a lot more thought and preparation that's gone into it, and that was certainly the case there.
Sure. Okay. Now I want to celebrate this picture here of your second place. There's a trophy there behind you too. But there you're standing on the podium with a second place and celebrating with your team. So tell me about those feelings with the team. I can see your teammates are super happy. You are obviously hot and sweaty and enjoying it. But the team is really thrilled too. Tell me about your team on these race days when it goes well.
Well, I'd probably start with the days that it goes badly, because the weird thing is with this small team dynamic like that is that everybody has put so much into getting either the aeroplane or the team or the tactics to the point where we've got the absolute best chance of success, but then it's just down to you in the aeroplane to go and deliver it. And that's a real pressure for, you know, not only because you want to do well in yourself as a pilot, but these guys have put their heart and soul into this. And when you clip a pylon or you pick up a penalty, all those weeks and months of hard work are literally just gone in a flash, which makes it all the better, all the more joyous when you do pull off the perfect run and you end up on the podium like this. So but mainly because yes there's a sense of personal pride that you've actually been able to fly the plane well and get it there. But for these guys to be able to reward all of their effort, all of their preparation, their cohesion, their teamwork, and then it actually paying off and you've succeeded is that's worth more than that trophy that I'm holding aloft there. The smiles on the face kind of say it all. So yeah, it's definitely a team effort, and the same is true that I alluded to with the Red Arrows, is that yes, people might see on television the race plane flying under a bridge, but actually it's the team behind it that got it there. So yeah, that was a pretty special day. That was last year in Budapest, but that's only our second year in the masterclass. And again, I think if you told us that when we started off in the masterclass year before last, that you know we'd be on the podium, and in fact we finished the world championship in fourth place that year. So yeah, we've come a long way pretty quickly, and that again is all down to the team.
Oh, it's nice shots of teamwork and the sort of celebration of, as you say, it's the end. What you see there is the snapshot at the end of a journey, and you know the journey. Really, one of the points I'd like to discuss on the show is that the journey's long. I mean, you've been flying for 20 plus years, doing, you know, reaching these sort of milestones along the way to enable to produce a result that the team can celebrate there too. Ben, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I think I could talk with you for the rest of the day, but I'm conscious of your time as well. It's been wonderful, the lessons learned. I'm going to leave you with one last question. What is your top tip in creating a high performance team?
In creating, well, I think certainly the top tip that I've learned throughout my whole flying career is just never give up and never let somebody tell you that you can't do something. Yeah, if you genuinely believe you can, then you can do it. And that's definitely been my mantra. I've met it many times along the way. So in terms of high performance teams and my advice there is that, you know, don't be overawed by the challenge ahead of you. If you get the right people, the right mentality, you put the right amount of work in, the right amount of preparation, and you are humble in your approach, I think that's a key thing for me, is that, you know, there should be no arrogance, no expectation of anything other than just allowing that hard work to pay off. Then you generally won't go wrong. And the only last bit of advice, you asked for one bit, I'll give you two, is that you are going to screw up along the way, or you are going to suffer disappointments and failures along the way. But your performance as a team or as a leader of that team down the road is directly proportional to the number of failures you've had generally, because you can learn so much from them. And you will never find somebody at the top of their game who hasn't suffered setbacks along the way. So don't be disheartened by it is the advice I would give.
So it sounds like humble and hungry. Thank you, Ben. It's been great chatting to you. All the best with the rest. And I hope you get up flying sometime soon. And we'll chat to you sometime before we go. What is your thoughts on the upcoming? You know, we've got early next year the race coming. What is the excitement around the new series? Is there a buzz behind the scene? Is there a WhatsApp group with race pilots talking and buzzing around? What's happening?
The buzz is starting to rise. Yeah, no, it's looking very encouraging. There is a new organization out there now, World Championship Air Race, who have gone quite a far way down the road now to putting a new race series in place. So. Yes, whilst there's nothing confirmed yet, I think I would be pretty confident there's going to be some racing next year. So, yeah, you'll see those aeroplanes up racing through pylons again. I am pretty confidently sure.
Well, thank you, Ben. Until next time, stay safe.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Alex.
Take care. Cheers.
Thank you for listening. I'm excited to have you on this journey with us. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and remember to subscribe to the show to catch weekly episodes so that you can build your high performance team.